This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. Social media has created a big generation gap. The digital gap used to be between those people who grew up before computers and smartphones and those who were digital natives. Now there's a gap between those who grew up with Facebook and those who grew up with Snapchat and Instagram. These gaps are central to the terrific new movie Eighth Grade, written and directed by my guest Bo Burnham. He became one of the first YouTube stars when he was in high school after he performed some of his own satirical songs, put them on YouTube for his family to see, and they went viral. After high school, he had his own MTV series, which satirized the compulsion to record and upload every aspect of your life, hoping it will make you famous. He's had two Netflix comedy specials, and he recently directed Chris Rock's latest comedy special. All that, and Burnham is only 27. The main character in his new movie, Eighth Grade, is Kayla, a girl who's on the verge of graduating from middle school. She's incredibly shy and socially awkward, but has her own YouTube vlog in which she gives advice as if she's confident and experienced enough to know how to help girls with the same problems she has, the kinds of problems that give her panic attacks. She has a few followers at best. Here's a scene from early in the film when Kayla is recording one of her videos.
Okay, so yeah, I hope to basically, you know, like, be yourself and don't care about, like, whatever what other people think about you, and just, like, you know, ignore them if they're being mean to you about it, and everything will work out if you're just being yourself. Thank you guys for watching this video. I hope some of you guys found it helpful, and make sure to subscribe to my channel. and, yeah, thank you for watching. Gucci!
Bo Burnham, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thanks for having me, Terry. It's an honor.
Thanks for saying that. I love your film, by the way. I just think it's great. You were in high school when you started posting songs on YouTube.
Yeah, junior in high school, yeah.
Yeah, so your songs on YouTube found a huge audience. You're a guy.
Mm.
So why did you want to make this movie from the point of view of an eighth grade girl? I mean, you've been through a big YouTube experience, much bigger than your character has. Why make it from an eighth grade girl's point of view?
You know, I set out to just make a story about how I was feeling at the time that I was writing it, which was nervous and sort of wanting to talk about the internet and how it felt to sort of be alive right now. And I kind of quickly found the world of kids expressing themselves online. I watched hundreds of videos of kids doing vlogs, like the vlog you just heard from Kayla. And the boys tended to talk about video games, and the girls tended to talk about their souls, so it was like, okay, I think this is probably going to be a story about a girl. But also, it was, I wanted to make a story about being young that didn't feel nostalgic and didn't feel like a memory. So it being a girl, sort of, I couldn't project my own experience onto her. I had to sort of walk eighth grade for the first time with her, because my disconnect from her is twofold. You know, I was never a 13-year-old girl, but I was also never a 13-year-old now, and I just think both of those things lend themselves to a specific experience that I can't know.
So you watched a lot of teen vlogs. What are some of the patterns that you saw? What are some of the things that really stuck out to you?
Well, there's some incredible, like, actual literal patterns. Like, they all actually open their videos by saying, "Hey, guys, so today I'm going to talk to you about," and then they go on to the topic. And then they almost always wrap up with the same phrase, "So I hope some of you found this helpful." And then they say, you know, like and subscribe and come to my channel. But it was really just the sort of layering of the performance of themselves. You know, you could see these kids in an instant grasping for a maybe speech or a type of speech that they had heard, trying to emulate that, failing to, trying to close the gap of that failure, reacting to their own failure of closing that gap, getting bored, getting sidetracked. All of those things were happening at once. I remember watching these videos thinking, if this were a performance in a movie, it would be incredible. You know, this is so much more complex than the usual sort of teen voiceover that you hear in movies that just kind of, okay, so I'm going to tell you how I went from being this to being that, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It was really about the failure of them to articulate themselves, and I just found that very fascinating and true. I mean, I just think that is the story of a lot of our lives, and certainly my life is trying to square the sort of vision you have of yourself in your head with what is coming out of the front of your face.
As you pointed out, you were never a 13-year-old girl. So I want to compare some of her anxieties with the ones you had as a boy of her age. She has a panic attack going to a popular girl's pool party. And the panic happens in the bathroom after she's changed into her bathing suit and is preparing to walk outside in it and is incredibly self-conscious about her body. So were you worried about appearing in a bathing suit?
No, I mean, I wasn't psyched about it. Like, I was sort of a late bloomer and, you know, didn't have hair under my armpits, so I would swim with my shirt on. But really, like, as an eighth grade boy, I was kind of a hammy loser. And, like, my anxiety didn't really wake up until I was maybe a sophomore in high school. And I was, you know, in and out of the hospital with stomach problems, thinking I had some gastro issue. And it really was, oh, I'm just nervous. But truly, the panic attacks and things, I relate much more to Kayla emotionally now than I did then. You know, I was having panic attacks, you know, backstage at the Wilbur Theater instead of in a bathroom before a pool party. But the feelings are the same. So, yeah, it really strangely was much more currently personal to me than it was personal then. I was just, as an eighth grade boy, I was just like eating dirt and running around. I don't know what I was doing.
What do you think the source of your anxiety was?
I don't know. Maybe, you know, my sister carrying me around, telling me I was the most special little boy on the planet, and then going out needing that validation from everybody in the world. I don't know. That's probably a pretty common one with my generation. But I don't know. I do think I just have a sort of chemical disposition for anxiety. I mean, my sister and my mother sort of share the anxiety that I have. It's a fear of authority, fear of the world. Who knows? Should I talk to somebody about this?
Your main character has, you know, social anxiety. She doesn't really have close friends. She's very uncomfortable around even kids her own age. Mm. What are some of your impressions of how social media is helping and hurting young people with social anxiety?
You know, my impulse was with the movie was to not want to be too instructive, not to give a TED talk, but rather just to take take emotional inventory of what's going on and sort of just present it. Because the truth is, it isn't just bad. If it was just bad, I'd just tell all the kids to throw their phone in the ocean and then it'd be really easy. The problem is, we are hyper-connected and we're lonely. We're overstimulated and we're numb. We're expressing ourselves and we're objectifying ourselves. So I think it just sort of widens and deepens the experiences of what kids are going through. But in regards to social anxiety, there's a part of social anxiety, I think, that feels like you're a little bit disassociated from yourself. And it's sort of like you're in a situation, but you're also floating above yourself, watching yourself in that situation, judging it. And social media literally is that. You know, it forces kids to not just live their experience, but be nostalgic for their experience while they're living it, watch people watch them. My sort of impulse is like, when the 13-year-olds of today grow up to be social scientists, I'll be very curious to hear what they have to say about it. But until then, it just feels like we just need to gather the data. And we're just trying to, with this movie, kind of have just an emotional, subjective experience of what it feels like.
You had a Netflix special a couple of years ago. And I want to play an excerpt of that because I thought you spoke really well about the need some people have to record everything they do and to have an audience and to be their own audience. So this is from Bo Burnham's 2016 Netflix special, Make Happy.
I was born in 1990 and I was sort of raised in America when it was a cult of self-expression. And I was just taught, you know, express myself and have things to say, and everyone will care about them. And I think everyone was taught that, and most of us found out no one gives a what we think. So we flock to performers by the thousands because we're the few that have found an audience, and then I'm supposed to get up here and say, follow your dreams, as if this is a meritocracy. It is not, okay? I had a privileged life, and I got lucky, and I'm unhappy. They say it's like the me generation. It's not. It's not. The arrogance is taught, or it was cultivated. It's self-conscious. That's what it is. It's conscious of self. What the social media? It's just the market's answer to a generation that demanded to perform. So the market said, here, perform everything to each other all the time for no reason. It's prison. It's horrific. It is performer and audience melded together. What do we want more than to lie in our bed at the end of the day and just watch our life as a satisfied audience member? I know very little about anything, but what I do know is that if you can live your life without an audience, you should do it.
Bo Burnham, do you still stand by everything you said in that?
Theatrically, sure, yeah. There's a sort of element of definitely dramatizing the feelings to express them. But yeah, I think so. I mean, what that really sort of expresses is the kind of major revelation I had in my career, which is, you know, I was feeling a very acute anxiety from my job of performing. You know, I was dealing with stage fright. I was having panic attacks on stage. And I felt like, man, my anxiety is so grounded in this specific circumstance of my life. Who is going to understand what I'm going through other than, at the time, another 24-year-old male comedian with an audience? And then I would talk about those problems in that circumstance on stage, and afterwards, kids, 14, 13-year-old girls would come up to me and say, I know exactly what you're going through. I'm going through it too. And I'd go, what? You know, it would be so confusing to me. And then I realized that this sort of like awful sort of D-list celebrity pressure I had experienced on stage has now been democratized and given to everybody. And everyone is feeling this pressure of having an audience, of having to perform, of having a sort of like proper noun version of your own name, and then the self in your heart. So really, if there was a bridge between me and 13-year-old girls that I had to walk in order to write this story, it was built by them to me first. You know, I felt personally understood by 13-year-old girls before I presumed to understand them.
You were an early YouTube star. You started making videos of you singing your original satirical songs in, I think, your bedroom. What was the state of YouTube when you started? And how old did you say you were, 15?
I was 16, yeah. It was 2006. It was just when it started, and I had written some little silly songs and wanted to show them to my brother, who was at college, and someone said, you should post it on YouTube. It's this site that you can post videos and share them. And I was like, oh, cool. And really, it was like, YouTube was just a place where it was like, you got a funny skit or something, post it here.
So when you started posting videos of your songs for your family, how did they end up going viral?
They were posted on this site, break.com, and it got like 250,000 views in a day. It just sort of happened. It was a website that sort of featured popular videos, and they just snagged it, and it kind of went crazy, and it was very strange because, you know, I saw this giant number, and then I, you know, went to school, and nothing was different. And I think it just sort of started a lifelong journey of these two separate sort of narratives being sort of absolutely incoherent, but overlaid on top of each other.
Why don't we hear what I think is the first song that you posted, which is which is
my I'll be checking out for this part.
My Whole Family, is that the first one?
Yeah, sure.
It's called My Whole Family, or My Whole Family Thinks I'm Gay. And you posted this in 2006, but your miking technique wasn't great. Your piano...
I would say basically all of my technique wasn't great. My technique for subtlety or writing or performing. But yeah, let's go with the mic technique.
Okay, we'll go with the mic technique. So the piano is like drowning out your voice, and I'm afraid our listeners won't be able to hear the lyrics. So instead of going with the original...
Thank God.
Wait, no.
Instead of Oh, Lord.
It's going to be bad again. Instead of going with the original YouTube video, we're going to go with the 2008 recording that you made, because it's just clearer.
And, oh, thank God.
And the lyrics are funny, and I think our audience should be able to hear them. So this is my guest, Bo Burnham.
Every time I go to dinner, seems like I'm getting a little bit thinner. I'll sit down at the breakfast table. I can talk, well, they're not able. When I look at them, I find there's a single question on their mind. I wish it could go back to the way it was. It's not easy now because my whole family thinks I'm gay. I guess it's always been that way. Maybe it's 'cause of the way that I walk makes them think I like boys. Did I like boys? question just won't go away, and I get asked every single day, but the way they ask it is not a disguise, like, how was your day? Do you like to kiss guys?
This is the worst. Oh, yeah, I had the headphones off, and I was in a full body sweat, so I didn't hear most of that. Truly, it's like, you know, I think it's, you know, for a 16-year-old kid in 2006, it's not bad, but the cultural standards of what is appropriate comedy and also the inner standards of my own mind have changed rapidly since I was 16.
Did people who you know think you were gay at the time?
Oh, sure, yeah.
Because you were a theater kid?
Diehard theater in an all-boys Catholic school, yeah.
And what was your reaction? Like, how did you know people thought you were gay, and what was your reaction to it?
Oh, you know, it was all cool. Like, you know, a lot of my close friends were gay, and, you know, I wasn't certain I wasn't at that point. But, yeah, like, it didn't mean much to me. Yeah, I didn't really care. I was going to do experimental theater at ETW, so I had at Tisch, so I had bigger fish to fry. I was doing Buto dances painted in all white. It was bad. Oh, boy.
Did people misinterpret it and think, like, that guy's homophobic?
I don't know that it's not. You know what I mean? I don't know that it's not. I don't defend my 16-year-old comedy at all. And, like, even part of this movie is me going back and, like, trying to forgive myself for what I was expressing at that time. The tact of a 16-year-old comic in 2006, which was, like, the peak of sort of, like, shock jock humor. I have a lot of material from back then that I'm not proud of and I think is offensive and I think is not helpful. But also I can't regret a bit of it, you know, because I deeply believe in the butterfly effect and I'm so grateful to be here right now. I do not think my intention was homophobic, but what is the implicit comedy of that song? If you chase it all the way down, I don't think it's perfectly morally defendable. But the issue is, and it'll be an issue I think for a lot of young creative people, my sort of open mic material, you know, the first stuff I wrote, is out there for everybody to see. So I just hope on my own behalf and other people's behalf, we're still allowed to think out loud and fail publicly and grow, because you know, at a certain point there's going to be every presidential candidate's going to have every bad joke they made when they're 13 immortalized on online. So at a certain point, we're going to have to call amnesty and just, you know, get on with it.
Well, that's the thing. Like, older people have deniability. Like, you can ask, like, what did you write when you were 13? What did you sing when you were 13?
Exactly.
It's like, oh, I just don't remember. And so you have deniability. But if it's on the internet and it's going to live there forever, like, you can't do that. On the other hand, you haven't taken down your YouTube channel with the old videos on it.
Yeah, I mean, because, you know, you can't erase it. I mean, they'd just be reposted, and it would almost be like I was trying to deny what's there. I mean, it's there. It's up there. But if I will denounce anything anyone wants me to. I basically denounce everything I've ever done up until this very point. That's always been sort of my creative process, is that I always think that the current thing I'm doing is a refutation of everything that came before it. But hopefully at a certain point I'll be able to start cultivating an oeuvre instead of just having an incoherent mess of things done by a child and now slowly a young adult.
So, but just in terms of, like, things that you're embarrassed about, in what year was your first... You're going to thank me for bringing this up.
Yes, let's do it.
What year was your first Netflix special?
2013, and then one more in 2016.
I think this is the 2013 one where you have a book of, like, poems and haikus on what you say is actually blank pages. You act like you're reading them, but you have one that's like, I F sluts.
Sure.
Is that a good example of something that you're sorry about now?
You know, like, it's the conversation of what is actually, like, permissible language has probably appropriately evolved very quickly. The sentiment in that one I enjoy, but I have personally soured on probably explicit satire. You know, there's certain, like, tools of satire that I think people have very little patience for now, which I understand. You know, a lot of this stuff, like, that one probably made a lot more sense pre-Trump. But now that Trump's here, it feels like, let's just not use these words. Like, there's no point to use this stuff in order to satirize the thing. because the satire of the thing and the thing actually look very similar now.
Oh, I know exactly what you mean, because you're satirizing that language, but it's a fine line, and a lot of people don't necessarily know what your intention is.
Yeah, and I think we've just really, very, very quickly, and it's the problem with comedy now, is that, like, we are really reexamining our culture.
So, you're really tall. You're, what, 6'5" or something?
6'6", unfortunately.
Oh, what kind of physical...
deformities?
No, I'm thinking, like, if you're 6'5", you can, like, slouch and try to cover up your height. You can really, like, own the space. Like, what type of tall person have you been, and has that changed over the years?
It has changed. That's a great question. I have just recently, in the last year, tried to stand up straight, because I always didn't. I always slouched. It's like a nightmare if I ever go to a theater to watch a play or something, and, like, you can just see the people watching me walk down the aisle, like, please, no. Please, God, no. And I have to give, like, hunched standing ovations. It's all very sad. Yeah, I'm trying to carry myself just, you know, upright nowadays. But, yeah, I was a slouch one for a while. I like to think of myself as collapsible, and people often, when I stand up, when I've been seated for a while, will say, oh, I didn't know you were tall, which is very, very high compliment for me. I hope I don't have the skull of a 6'9" person. I like to think that I don't appear tall until I'm all of a sudden towering over you.
Why were you self-conscious about being tall leading to slouching?
Just, like, too much. Like, 6'6" is too much. Like, 6'2", cool. You know, 6'6" is like, oh boy. I get a lot of, do you play basketball? Which is, the response is, do you play mini golf? or are you a jockey? Or you get, how's the weather up there? And then you say it's raining and you spit in their face. You don't do that. But, no, it's just like, it's too much. Yeah, it's a lot.
Well, Bo Burnham, it's been great to talk with you. I love the movie. Thank you so much for coming on our show.
Well, appreciate it, Terry. Thank you for having me.
Bo Burnham wrote and directed the new movie, Eighth Grade. Our rock critic Ken Tucker has a review of a new album by Gorillaz called The Now Now. Gorillaz is often referred to as a virtual band. It consists of four members who are animated characters appearing in cartoon videos. The band is co-created by visual artist Jamie Hewlett and musician Damon Albarn. Here's Ken's review.
In the music video that accompanies that new song, Humility, the Gorillaz character called 2D roller skates around what looks like California's Venice Beach, sometimes in tandem with a live-action Jack Black, himself a kind of human cartoon. It's a bright, cheery animation that's at odds with the lyric of the song, in which the word isolation pops up a lot as the narrator fights a losing battle with it. Humility kicks off the album, and the brightness of its pop melody versus the darkness of its sentiments sets the tone for the rest of this album, The Now Now. There's a satisfying crunch to a medium tempo tune such as Kansas. I'm not gonna cry. The memory of my fall from grace in your heart. chief musical human behind Gorillaz cartoons is singer and songwriter Damon Albarn, who's also the lead singer of the British band Blur. The music Albarn writes for Gorillaz is a mixture of pop and electronic music and hip-hop. Albarn, as a gorilla, sings most frequently in a languid croon emerging from an electronic filter. It gives his voice a ghostly resonance, a lofty, aloof air.
Every sound from everyone receiving, everyone receiving you,
Gorillaz' previous album, 2017's Humans, was stuffed to the gills with guest stars, including Grace Jones, Noel Gallagher, Mavis Staples, and the rappers Vince Staples and Pusha T. The collection had the air of a major effort, a cartoonish grand opus. This new album, The Now Now, is smaller scale. Its guest musicians are limited to cameos by Snoop Dogg on one track, and jazz guitarist George Benson playing on the song Humility. The result is a more intimate album, as well as a less chilly, more inviting one.
Gorillaz has now been in existence for 2 decades. Damon Albarn has turned 50. You'd think the musical adventures of cartoon characters would bore him by now, but the Now Now possesses an eager energy. He begins the album singing the line, "Calling the world from isolation," and as the album proceeds, it reveals itself as an argument for engagement. It's not a wispy wish for connection, it's a bold assertion of it. A friendly insistence that no matter what our differences, we ought to remain sympathetic to each other. There's nothing cartoonish about that sentiment at all.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Yahoo TV. He reviewed Gorillaz' new album called The Now Now. One of the first women bands to play punk and break into that world, defying the preconceptions about how women should look and sound, was the British band The Slits. My guest Viv Albertine was the guitarist and lyricist. Their 1979 album, Cut, was in Rolling Stone's list of the 40 greatest punk albums of all time. The Slits were described as, quote, following Patti Smith in defining punk as feminist implicitly and explicitly. And like their UK comrades, the Raincoats, they did it not merely by forming an all-women band, itself a radical move, but with music owing little to punk dude dogma. Unquote. Albertine says after the band split up in the 80s, she quit making music and living in squats and tried to stop being an angry young woman. She went to film school and became a TV director. She got married, was diagnosed with cancer 3 months after their daughter was born, and nearly died. Now she's divorced, her daughter is in college, and Albertine has become a writer, a really good one. Her first memoir, Close, 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 Music, 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 Boys, 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 was published in 2014. Her new memoir is titled To Throw Away Unopened. Viv Albertine, welcome to Fresh Air. So you have 2 great memoirs. I'm going to ask you to start with a reading from the first one, Close, 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 Music, 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 Boys, Boys, Boys.
Yeah. I studied record covers for the names of girlfriends and wives. That's how I connected girls to the world I wanted to be in. I scanned the whole of the thank yous and the lyrics looking for girls' names, especially if I fancied the musician. What are these girls like who go out with poets and singers? What have they got that I haven't? I read the book Groupie by Jenny Fabian, and I'm ashamed to say that I thought it sounded okay being a groupie. But I knew I wasn't witty, worldly, or beautiful enough to even be that. The only other way left for a girl to get into rock and roll was to be a backing singer, and I couldn't sing. Every cell in my body was steeped in music, but it never occurred to me that I could be in a band, not in a million years.
Why not? Why didn't it occur to you that you could be in a band?
It wasn't part of our society. I mean, you know, obviously there's no internet, no way to sort of hear or see of a young woman somewhere in the world who might play an electric guitar. So if it didn't make its way to my little, you know, apartment with my family in North London in, you know, some other way, I never heard of anyone, any female playing guitar. Eventually I heard of Susie Quattro and Fanny and then the Runaways, but because I read the music press so avidly, I was aware of how constructed they were by male managers. So even they didn't really tweak in my brain a little part of me that let me think I could do that. They were American, they were, you know, exotic, they were put together, they were beautiful, and, you know, a man was in charge.
So getting back to the reading that you did when you'd studied record covers, looking for the names of girlfriends and wives, was that your goal, to become the girlfriend or wife of a musician?
Sadly, it was my goal to become a girlfriend or a wife of a musician. I honestly couldn't conceive of any other way of being amongst creative musical people, men. I didn't know women could be part of that group. So, it's sad looking back, but I'm just so glad that I, among with other people, formed something that was then later called punk, where there was a door for young women. And of course, the young women, especially us, the Slits, who were drawn to being in a band, couldn't play because we'd never had role models and never occurred to us to sit in our bedrooms playing electric guitar. And actually, that turned out to be a real bonus, I think, because the music the Slits made was so intuitive and self-taught. There's such a sort of authenticity and a truthfulness to it. We weren't attempting to copy boys' music. We were very deliberately not playing 12-bar structures, blues structures, which, you know, rock musicians had turned into such a cliche, and normal chord progressions. We tried to literally go inside our bodies and listen to the rhythms within ourselves and take the normal words we used every day and our normal thoughts, which girls hadn't written about before.
Well, why don't we hear a track from the Slits' first album? And this is a song that you initiated, that you brought to the band, and then the members of the band expanded the song, and it's called So Tough. So I'm going to play the 2009 remastered version, I think it's from 2009, of the song, because it sounds clearer. And the original version of this was recorded in the late 70s. So here's the Slits' So Tough.
Don't take it serious.
That's the Slits performing So Tough, my guest Viv Albertine on guitar. And she's written two great memoirs. The first one, about her early years and getting into music, is called Close, 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 Music, 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 Boys, Boys, Boys. And the new one, which picks up after that, and way after that, actually, it covers a lot of her life, but she's writing it from the vantage point of looking back on her life from ages 59 and 60. And that one's called To Throw Away Unopened. So what was it like to actually be on stage with the Slits? You wanted for so long to be in music, to have the power of like being the guitarist on stage. Did it feel like you wanted it to feel?
Well, don't forget, I hadn't wanted it for so long.
That's true. You didn't think you were capable of doing it. That's true.
No. That's I didn't right. think girls did that. So I hadn't right. yearned. I'd yearned to be amongst musicians and be part of an artistic circle. So within sort of moments of me having the thought that I can pick up a guitar, which is came to me when I saw the Sex Pistols play live in about 76, the next day I was going out to buy one. So I was, you know, very aware of breaking down the sort of tropes of being a musician and wanting to go against them, not wanting to fall into old male habits. But at the same time, I didn't know what to replace it with. So the Slits took a lot of time out of our rehearsal periods, which were in old squats, old broken down houses around London, talking about how should we stand? What position should we put our legs in? Does it look odd to have my skirt this short with a guitar? Or should I have it a bit longer so it sticks out the bottom? You know, people say, oh, why haven't women done this more or that more? But it takes so much longer to get to the stage where a man is, because all the bands in punk that I knew or were beginning to form had all spent years and years practicing with a hairbrush in front of a mirror, with a tennis racket, you know, looking at pictures of other guys they wanted to be. They skipped all that. We could have skipped it if we just copied them. And girl bands still do just copy the way men move on stage. To me, that is so backwards, so unradical. So we took a lot of time thinking about how we were going to stand, what we would wear to make the proportions of the guitar and the dress look good or look crazy. We didn't care either way. Thinking about the chord progressions we'd use, the timbre of voice we sang in, because most girls at that time and women, unless they were sort of Dionne Warwick or Dusty Springfield, someone really amazing, sang in high, breathy, girly voices, you know, the pop singers. We didn't want to sing in those voices. I used to say to the girls, sing in the same register of voice that you would use if you were shouting across a playground at school to someone right on the other side of the playground. And it's not that different to the register of a male voice.
It seems like you consciously decided not to sexualize yourselves on stage, to dress, you know, in clothes that would be considered like really sexy and arousing.
Well, the clothes we wore were very considered, but also lots of humor in it. So we would jumble up something like, you know, S&M dog collars with rubber stockings mixed with a little girl's tutu mixed with man's construction boots you'd wear on a construction site, hair matted, black eye makeup. It was all thrown together, all parodying all the clothes and the symbols you were supposed to wear as a woman, and then mix in things that weren't meant to go with it at all. And we just stopped people in their tracks as they walked down the road. They couldn't believe it. A lot of the response from men, straight men especially, in the streets was, if you're not going to look like a woman and play the game and act like a woman as we've prescribed, we're not going to treat you as women, and we're going to beat the hell out of you, abuse you, spit at you. We were assaulted everywhere we went. We had to go everywhere in a band, four astride, sleep on the floor of each other's flats at night. Otherwise, we're not safe on the streets. I mean, our singer, who was 14, 15 when we first got together, was stabbed twice in front of me by men. Stabbed for looking like she looked.
What did this do to your feelings about men?
Well, I was raised to have very, very little respect for men by my mother. That was before I had a say in, you know, in how I was raised. She did indoctrinate me against men. Well, against patriarchy, to be fair.
And against your father, who left you both when you were a child and abused, beat you with a belt and abused your mother, too.
Yeah, so she was not cool with men. And not for no reason. She had not only been stymied in her work, you know, put down, not promoted, etc., etc., not even got jobs. I mean, after the war, I was born 9 years after the war, you couldn't get a job if you were married. I mean, women used to take off their wedding rings and have to pretend they weren't married to even get any little job. It was part of a government drive to make sure men coming back from the war had work. I mean, it made sense, but women had tasted freedom because they'd worked during the war, you know, building the planes, doing the rivets, you know, the whatever, and then it had been taken away from them. So, you know, there were many resentments in women of my mother's generation, and I think they brought up their daughters to be quite militant and to carry the resentment of their mother's generation within them. And I think that's why we had such a strong feminist surge amongst my age group.
You were married for a bunch of years. I forget how many. You had a daughter.
17.
17 years you had a daughter together, divorced when she was 8. At some point, your husband said to you, either give up music or it's over. I'm leaving. And considering the feminist statements you were making with your music and with your life, what was it like to hear that from your husband? And when was this in terms of the place that music had in your life? Was this like long after the Slits?
My husband and I got together. I was a filmmaker then, or a director. He liked that very much about me. I was earning good money. He was 10 years younger than me. He'd been a fan of the Slits, had a poster of us on the wall. So he was kind of excited. He was going out with dating, you know, the guitarist from the Slits. But at the same time, he was very pleased I'd put it behind me. I didn't know why until 20 years later, when I picked up the guitar again and said, I'm going to start playing again, and realized that he was frightened of losing me. There was this whole concoction in his head of a young woman or a woman on stage is just attracting male glances, you know, wants to sleep with them, will have loads of groupies. For someone younger than me and an illustrator and a surfer, it was very, very reactionary. And I was incredibly shocked. And you never know a person. You know, we'd been through my cancer together. We'd been through years and years of infertility. We'd had a daughter. We'd stood up to all those things. But me picking up a Telecaster broke our marriage. And that's what made me walk away from the marriage. And I was very sorry to do that because I wanted my daughter to have a steady family, the one I didn't have. So it was not an easy decision.
You know, you write in your new memoir, To Throw Away Unopened, that you'd been married, divorced, in between, had 7 years of infertility treatments, 13 operations, 11 IVF attempts, one miscarriage, one ectopic pregnancy, a gallbladder removed, cancer, which was diagnosed 3 months after giving birth to your daughter. Did all of this give you a feeling of vulnerability about yourself and about things that could go wrong with your body? After presenting this kind of angry and vulnerable image on stage when you were younger,
yeah, the image on stage was angry and invulnerable, and I kept that with me, even though I had those years of feeling lost after the band broke up. But when I got hit with all that physical illness and problems, which went on for about 10 years, it did make me feel scared. I'd never felt scared before. My mother brought me up to be very reckless. And then suddenly my mortality was staring me in the face so literally that I was lying in bed at night thinking, you know, I'm probably going to die. I've got a 6-month-old baby. They're saying it's not looking good. And, you know, to face the spectre of death on your own at night, there's no other feeling like it. It's the most alone you'll ever feel. And people say after cancer, you know, you come back fighting and you come back grabbing every moment as if, you know, you've got no tomorrow, and it gives you this courage. It didn't do that to me. Maybe because I'd lived those years already feeling that, I suddenly felt all my courage taken away from me. And it probably took a good 10 years to gradually build it back up. And I wasn't the same person. I built a different person, a more circumspect, a more compassionate person, but certainly not the daredevil I was before.
What happened to all the anger that you had?
That remained. And so that to me was the thread of the second book. Why is this middle-aged woman so full of anger? Why am I so full of anger?
So since your music in the Slits was in part a way of expressing your anger, and your new memoir is in part about trying to understand the source of your anger, how it's affected your life, how you've dealt with it over the years, how you deal with it now. What did you try to teach your daughter about how to deal with anger?
Well, the interesting thing is my daughter doesn't have that anger. She has a different personality to me, much more grounded, but also different times. The fights for her are different. She doesn't have to literally kick down doors, which I have done in the past in my Dr. Martin boots, to get heard. There are other parts of society and the world who do still have to do that, women and men. But for a young white woman in London, it isn't so hard as it was for me. So I don't think she has the same level of anger. She may feel it on behalf of other people, and I think a lot of young people do feel anger on behalf of other people in the world, and I hope that generation, in a way, and I think they will, a lot of them, become sort of enablers to sort of, rather than being the people who jump up on stage and show off, that they'll actually help people less advantaged have a voice, or even just step back and let someone else talk and sing and paint whose culture hasn't been heard, you know, in the sort of dominant world.
It has been great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Terry.
Viv Albertine's new memoir is called To Throw Away Unopened.